Accession number 16251, rail 2.
Major Winter, rail 2.
It was at the time of Dunkirk. So the time frame is roughly the end of May, June, that we were there in the Orkney Islands. After we knew that Dunkirk had taken place, we were posted to the mainland, and we were billeted in a church hall at Kirkintilloch. And Kirkintilloch was, unfortunately for us, I won't say we were hard drinking, but Kirkintilloch was a dry town. There was not a pub in the place, and the thing that was required there was some way to let your hair down. So the only way we could do that was by going into Glasgow itself. And we didn't stay there too long. We went into Glasgow, and we found that the hours of drinking there were most peculiar as well. We didn't understand the Scots at all. Let me put it that way.
But they were mostly HLI you were with.
They were HLI. Anyhow, whilst we were in this billet, a commanding officer came along and told us that we were to be disbanded. The independent companies had done their job, good chaps, you know, that sort of thing. And he said, however, there's a new unit going to be formed, and this will be a unit called Commando. Now, you'll be given the opportunity of volunteering for this, if you so wish. Its role will be similar to that what you have already been doing in Norway, but this time you'll be properly trained. Well, I was single, and I quite enjoyed soldiering as such, and I volunteered to become a member of Number 9 Commando, we were formed. And Number 9 Commando, I'm not sure what they did. I only did training with them. But I understand they eventually went out to China to join up with Merrill's Marauders or something like that. As for me, I had been promoted to my peacetime substantive rank of sergeant by the records office. And as such, because the establishment of this commando unit only called for a corporal, I was therefore posted away from the commandos to Hatfield, where they were forming a new general hospital. Now, we did a lot of commando training, actually, while I was with them, at Fort William, at the Commando Training Centre, at Speen Bridge. And we quite enjoyed the idea, because commandos got paid extra pay for finding their own accommodation. And you just had to obey instructions to report to somewhere about 15 miles away for a parade next morning. Make your own way there, that type of thing. And we were taught how to swim with full battle order on our backs and that sort of thing. It was virtually, in many ways, the beginnings of combined operations training, which was very tough going, I must admit. And I know it's a lot tougher now, from what I can see, than what we had to put up with. Anyhow, that's diverse, diverting. When I left commandos to join the 38th General Hospital at Hatfield House, the 38th was already forming up there on a medical unit that was already working the Hatfield House as a hospital. So we were there really as a, just to form up. I was promoted sergeant and joined the sergeant's mess for the first time ever and began to enjoy life within the mess, that sort of thing, is distinct from being a private soldier scrambling for your place at a meal table. Everything was more civilized. And while I was at Hatfield House, I met Betty, because one of the chaps I was billeted with, we all billeted in Hatfield, in private houses. And the, do you remember her name? The person I was billeted with, I can't remember it. Anyhow, he saw that I was at a loose end and brought me over to St. Albans one day, where I met my wife. Because his wife was the sister of Betty's mother. And I was only there, what was it, June, something like that, July.
This is 41 we're talking
41
about.
41 we're talking about now. And we got married, actually, on November the 13th in 1941. A lucky day for both of us, because this is now 53 years later we're talking about. And we're still together and very happy. We were only married about 3 weeks when I got a posting order together with all the unit, of course, to go to Liverpool, where we embarked on board a ship. And we had no idea, Betty didn't know where I was going. Nobody knew where we were going. We were just on board a troop ship. And it was the, I think it was one of the Empress boats.
Did you run into the enemy on the way?
We were very fortunate. We didn't run into the enemy. We went way, way south in the Atlantic and then doubled back and came into Durban. And we had a week in Durban where we were billeted on South African families who took us in and sort of treated us like royalty. And we had no idea where our final destination was going to be. So when we got back on board the ship, I managed while I was in Durban to send Betty some nylons, something they hadn't seen in England up till then. And funnily enough, when I got back, she was still wearing a pair of nylons after being abroad for 3.5 years. So they served a very good purpose. Where am I now?
You're on your way to India. South Africa.
We stopped off at South Africa, and we then found ourselves actually approaching the gateway to India, Bombay. And we offloaded, and there's no mean feat. A 1,200-bedded general hospital has a lot of equipment with it, everything. And it took 2 or 3 days to offload our equipment. And we went up to Dulali, and we stayed there waiting for final instructions. And final instructions were, get back on to Bombay again. And we went to Bombay, loaded all our equipment back on the board a ship. It was called the Captain Jack. Suddenly how memory comes back. The Captain Jack. And it was a French boat, and we were the only troops on board that ship. That was the 38th General Hospital. And when we eventually surfaced, we found we were at Basra. And we had to set up a tented hospital in the Shaiba Desert, outside Basra. And we set up a whole hospital because we were in support of the 12th Army, which was sent there to put down the insurrection by Mossadegh, I think.
I think that was later, after the
President.
War.
No, this fellow was there. I'm sure it was Mossadegh at that time.
In Persia?
In Yes. I'm absolutely certain it was. But nothing came of it. We didn't get any casualties. We just sat and waited and waited and waited. Nothing happened. And then we packed up, went back to Basra again, and back to India. And this time, instead of staying at Dulali, we were posted straight up to Bangalore. And at Bangalore, we took over the barracks, which were then unoccupied, and formed it into a general hospital. I was a qualified nurse, and nursing I was engaged on at that time was the venereal, because there was a mass of venereal disease out there. And I was in charge of the venereal ward. And it was a job I hated. I liked nursing. I liked it. But I don't like things connected with that sort of thing.
Was that because of moral disapproval? Or some other reason?
Partly. I could see no sense in treating these chaps and getting them cleared of venereal disease and then find them coming back again, having been reinfected. There didn't seem to be any sense to it. I used to try and knock some sense into them at times. And it was a tragic thing because there was syphilis was out there, it was endemic as well. And we used to have the odd case of tertiary syphilis, which affects the brain and they die, and that's it. It was demoralizing for me, anyhow.
Could I just ask you something here? Because I interviewed a man last week who served in India in the war. He was a regular soldier in the infantry. And he claimed that he saw British soldiers, or ex-British soldiers in Calcutta, who had been infected with syphilis, who had been left behind by the army, dismissed by the army because they'd caught VD, and who were in the last stages with their joints having gone and being on trolleys begging in the streets of Calcutta. Can you imagine that could be so?
No, I couldn't imagine that. I couldn't imagine that.
Would they be dismissed from the army for catching VD? Would they be left behind in India?
I would think not. There's no way, in fact, I could see that they would do that. The medical service had an obligation to treat everybody, irrespective. And if they couldn't deal with them, I admit they couldn't sort of send them back to UK hospitals, but there were several Indian general hospitals throughout the Indian continent to which they could have been sent, and we would have done that because we were a mobile unit, you see, earmarked to go up to Burma eventually. But I just can't imagine that happening. I really can't.
But is it true that their joints would collapse?
Oh, joints get affected, yes. It's syphilis is a debilitating disease in every respect. And it wasn't, you see, in those days we didn't have much in the way of I mean, you take an ordinary gonorrhea case, for instance. We had to treat them with douches. Whereas nowadays, you just stick a bit of penicillin into the chap and it goes back and sins again and comes back in again for another dose of penicillin. But it wasn't so in that case. You had to douches, you had to nurse them. The syphilis cases, there wasn't a great deal you could do for them because there was no anti-syphilitic drug in those days. So it was, you know, it was a really devastating period. And that's what annoyed me so much, the people going around reoffending and going away and coming back. And I couldn't see the sense of it.
So the treatment in those days for syphilis in the Indian hospital was ineffective?
Well, yes. Yes. Once you got syphilis, you're very lucky to get over it. Especially if you got tertiary syphilis, which was the worst, of course, because it affected your brain then. And you died without any doubt whatsoever.
So you said you were discontented with this job. Was there anything you could do about it?
Yes, well, I tried. There was a ruling in those days that field ambulances were always requiring grade A category soldiers. And they had a number of grade B and C categories, and they didn't want them. They wanted all grade A because they had to be physically fit. Whereas you can work in a hospital and not be absolutely top grade. And every so often the hospital was asked for two nurses, shall we say, class one rank and whatever else it was they wanted. And the commanding officer had a duty to provide them and receive in their place the equivalent rank, but downgraded medically. So that, in other words, all your fit people went to the front. As it happens, there wasn't a front in those days because the units were only training. And I had... I'd been to my CO, and he was an old, old pre-war type of soldier, whose every word had to be obeyed, and I quite agree, I tried to do my best. But whatever I did, it wasn't good enough for him. He'd nitpick all the time and that sort of thing. And so I used to go out to his veranda as soon as I knew there was a requirement for a sergeant of a nursing orderly grade one trade required for a field unit. I'd be on his veranda with two or three other sergeants, and he'd always send one of the others away. And I would be left... I was too valuable in the job I was doing, which is what he used to tell me. And you can't be sort of too valuable and yet not get, you know, what you want. He was looking after number one, really, I suppose. He'd nitpick at me and then tell me I was no good. And then when I went to get away, I was too valuable. So, you know, it's you can imagine the discontent that arises from that. But anyhow, I got fed up with it in the end, and I was one of the few regular sergeants in the unit, and I got the others together one day, and I threatened to knock their heads together if anybody else volunteered the next time a suitable vacancy came up. And one came up shortly afterwards, and I was the only one on his veranda. So he had no choice but to post me then, and I went down to Bombay, where number five field ambulance was training in a combined operations role for, I believe it was going to go to Malaya. But circumstances obviously changed the situation because I'd been with them for a while and I got promotion to staff sergeant within a few weeks. And on the RQMS, not too very long after that. And I felt much better about it because I was doing some real hard training. I know Betty would have been horrified because I told her I would look after myself and I wouldn't volunteer for anything. But she didn't know what was going on, so it didn't matter, did it, Bert? No, I know. Anyhow, the upshot was that suddenly the Japanese invaded India, right through Assam, and got to within 30-odd miles of the railway at Dimapur. And we were flown, not my own particular, but the division was flown. One brigade went straight to the Arakan, where there was another push there. My brigade went up the narrow gauge railway to Dimapur, and as soon as we got there, virtually before we had time to settle down, the battalions were deployed, and the Scottish regiment that was in our brigade made first contact with the enemy. I think it's a milestone 30 or 32 or something from the railroad to Dimapur.
Was that the Royal Scots?
No, it wasn't the Royal Scots. We had the Dorsets, the Worcester Regiment, and what's the other one? The Scottish one. No, it wasn't the Royal Scots. They were in another brigade altogether.
But in the same division?
Same division, yes.
This was two division?
Two division, yes.
And five brigade, we should say.
That's right. Two division, five brigade. Anyhow, they had the Camerons, sorry. Funny, I should have forget them. They were the first troops to suffer casualties. As they were approaching contact, this is where the Roman Catholic Padre was killed by a mortar bomb that dropped into the ditch at the side of the road that he jumped into to escape the mortaring, instead of which he was killed outright. Sorry. We followed on afterwards and got to within fairly easy reach once we got this stronghold, if you like, of Japanese advanced stronghold cleared out of the way. The brigade moved forward to relieve Kohima, which at that time was being held by the Royal West Kents and an assorted garrison of all sorts of Assam regiment, I think, and quite a mixed batch there. And they've been having a hell of a time. And we couldn't do anything about it until we managed to get through the Worcesters and the Dorsets and the Camerons. All went through, and some of 4 Brigade as well, and relieved Kohima after a really vicious battle. It was vicious because it lasted so long. We were 17 days at Kohima itself. I was on Hospital Hill up with brigade headquarters, battalion headquarters, because I'd been seconded from the field ambulance as a staff sergeant in charge of a section to join up with the battalion regimental aid post because they had the stretcher bearers. And these stretcher bearers were located at company level, so they could bring the casualties back to the regimental stretcher bearer headquarters. And my doctor, Captain Swallow, and Captain Chamberlain, the medical officer of the Dorsets, amalgamated to form what you might call a little hospital itself. And we dug a huge pit and covered it over with trees and stuff like that, lined it with parachutes that were being dropped every day, and formed a little hospital unit. And in fact, we had an ADMS out there, the Assistant Director of Medical Services, who was a fellow called Colonel Officer. And he said that he wanted every one of his field ambulances in the division to be able to bring the nursing and surgical work up to the standard of Guy's Hospital, to have that sort of thing in the field. And that was his ultimate aim. And we tried our best, naturally, to do this. We tried to get the troops off stretchers, you know, the sick and wounded. And we managed to get the Royal Engineers to cut a lot of posts down to 2x2 size, and we were able to manufacture beds. I had several carpenters in my unit, and I set them doing this, and we had these ground sheets that in those days you could put a rope through the eye holes and use them as the basis for a bed. So we made, on average, I think, 90 to 100 of these, and we were able to, therefore, to hold the casualties in comparative safety from shelling and mortaring in beds. And we also managed to get, and this was the ADMS's decision, we also managed to get some sheets dropped by air, so that when a soldier came into our location at Kohima, he didn't have a rough old blanket. He didn't have any smiling girls, but at least he had white sheets on a bed. And you'd be surprised at what a difference this made to the morale of troops, to know that they were at least being looked after, instead of just being thrust on an old stretcher and somebody coming along, giving a couple of tea every now and then. They were really being cared for. And I contributed no mean way to the fact that the soldiers were very pleased with the whole outfit. In fact, strange enough, I, for the first time ever, in the magazine that we get from the Burma Star Association, there was an entry in there from a soldier of the Dorsetshire Regiment. And he eulogized on the field ambulance work at Kohima. Now, that's a first. We've never appeared on the order of battle that you saw. So the engineers, the signals and all that, medics, well, they were just medics. And, you know, they didn't appear in the order of battle. I personally felt a little hurt about that. After the war, that is, I didn't realize at the time that we were not shown under these orders of battle. But at present at Kohima, but we were there, a whole section of the field ambulance, and we were there for quite a long while and suffered the same privations. We manned our portion of the perimeter in case of a sudden Japanese attack. I had a Thompson submachine gun in those days, and most of the others had Sten guns. And we were able, would have been able to do our work if the Japanese had in fact broken through, which is what we feared, because we knew about